The only other things that I have before we get into this new section on the suffrage campaign, which is the picketing, are just some questions I wrote down that have to do with the administration of the National Woman's Party.
All
just
right,
little
please.
Things, and yeah. I might just run through them,
yes,
and see
too.
If you can tell anything.
Sue, please.
I would just wonder about them as I read things. One thing was, in the suffrages, did you write a lot of the articles in the suffrages?
I wrote a lot of the editorials. I didn't write anything else excepting whenever we didn't have an editor. For instance, during the period that we were having our 1916 election campaign, we had nobody at that moment who was editing the paper. And so I remember that I did it from Chicago. And I had to not only write the editorials, but I had to assemble and so on.
Oh, my.
All the material. And I remember I just didn't see how I could do it, so I decided that I would stay up all night, every other night. One night I would go to sleep, and the next night, as soon as it became, because all through the day you were having telephones, you were having people, and you couldn't do anything. So at night, when everybody had gone, and the charwomen came in to clean the building and so on, we had this big room down on the street, I told you, with big show windows, and it was very safe because you were exposed to every, nothing really could happen, and I think in the light, you just seemed to be one of the late workers in the office. So, every other night, I took up the suffragist problem, and we got it out all through the election campaign, but that's the only time that I took on the whole responsibility of the paper.
How long did that keep up? I don't see how your health held up.
How what?
I don't see how your health held up. Missing your sleep every other night.
Well, I tell you, that's what this doctor said. I have the heart block. I don't know whether I have or not.
You're still one of the most active and brightest people I know your age. Some of these I've already asked you. Let me check down here. Oh, I thought you might like to give a few statements on types of women that were in this campaign. For instance, it wasn't a lower class working women's campaign, was it? It was primarily handled by women who had independent means or who had a time to do this and who were in a position of influence and power. These were the women who really seemed to do the work. Is this impression right?
Well, see, when we went to prison, the woman who was in the same room with me in the psychopathic ward was Rose Winslow, and she was, as far as I know, I think she was a Polish immigrant, and completely what you would call the working class.
Yeah, I noticed you did have some.
And then we had Nina Sabaradin, who was the one that gave us our suffrage song, you know, because in prison she would always sing this haunting melody, which we adopted as the Women's Party song, "The Walls That Hold Us." You remember that song?
Mm-hmm.
And in our words, but she, of course, sang it in Russian. And she was a Russian immigrant. Her father, we'll say, was a tailor or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had, it seemed to me, every kind of, from the beginning to the end, of every kind of woman.
You did, Alice, but I mean, in your general profile, instead of, you know, there are different kinds of campaigns, and some campaigns just start with organizing masses and masses of people, which you did not have the time or funds to do, you told me a while ago. And so it seemed to me that what you had done was choose women who were in strategically important positions.
I think more we chose anybody who would come. We sort of put up a banner when we began to work for this amendment all alone, about 15 of us, you see, to start this little group, after the National American cast us out, put in another amendment. And that's the reason we didn't know whether we could survive or whether we ought to do it or try to do it even. And so all we did was to put up this banner, what we stood for.
Mm-hmm.
And women would come, wherever you went, women would come.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever came, we welcomed. Whoever she might be.
Well, in your positions of leadership, did you have a preponderance of college-educated women?
No, we never thought about it.
It appeared to me that you did.
Well, we didn't. It's very likely that... I remember in this campaign... Not this campaign, but the Equal Rights Amendment campaign, that... National Association, let's see what's it called, AAUW, American Association of University Women,
mm-hmm.
of which I was a member then, and almost all college women joined it,
mm-hmm.
and they had a headquarters in Washington. They sent a letter to every member of Congress, signed by their executive director of the national headquarters, opposing the Equal Rights for Women Amendment. And I went over then to see Miss M. Carey Thomas of Bryn Mawr, who'd been a strong supporter always of ours, and asked her if she would come down to their coming convention in Washington of this association and try to stop this opposition. And she said she would. Mrs. Lawrence Lewis and I, Mrs. Lewis was always our strongest woman in Philadelphia, we went out together to see her, and she said she would, and she did. She came. And immediately she tried to use her great influence as the foremost woman college president in the United States and the foremost woman educator, perhaps. I think the greatest woman in the field of education we ever had in America. So she had a great deal of prestige, we thought. And she proposed that they take up this whole subject and study it and immediately rescind this action that they'd taken. And she's carried it. And as a result of that meeting in Washington, this executive director was probably dismissed, but anyway, she disappeared. She was no longer there. The one who'd sent out this letter, her name was Myna Kerr from the University of Wisconsin, who'd been employed to be their executive director. And they sent out, she didn't get a wholesale endorsement of the Equal Rights Amendment, but she got the endorsement of having nothing to do with this letter that's going to every member of Congress, disowning it. And they sent out a letter to every member of the AAOW giving the pros and cons on this amendment. And Miss Thomas wrote the pros and sent around the country. And so for a time we heard nothing more of opposition from the AAOW. Then came their meeting out in Oregon, and by some trick, it seemed to us, because people didn't know it was coming up, they brought this subject up and voted to oppose the Equal Rights Amendment, thing they'd withdrawn their opposition some years before. So I went up to see Miss Thomas again. By this time, she'd retired as being president, but I met her at some relative's home in Maryland, in Baltimore, and told her this whole tale, and she said, "Well, I have decided never to go to another convention of the AAUW or have anything further to do with them. I've done the best I could. I created the organization." And said, "The college women today are so different from the college women in the early pioneer days when every woman was a personality. And now they all do what the popular thing is." And that's been my experience with these college women, too. Because they haven't been much of a help to us.
In the days of the suffrage amendment, were they more individualistic? Is that what she meant?
No, she meant back in the early days when they were...
Really
early. Beginning to early days of college education for women.
Oh, I see.
Her early days when she became president of Bryn Mawr and started something unheard of. which was a girls' college with equal academic standards with the men's colleges.
Yeah.
You know, Woodrow Wilson was one of her professors, and she went forth and she had a doctor's degree from Zurich herself,
mm-hmm.
was a highly educated woman. She was a Quaker, by the way, and she got up a group of people, of professors that were equal to those in the men's colleges. She lifted up college education for women to where it had never been before. And I had the same feeling about these college women. You see, of our own college, Swarthmore, which Lucretia Mott, imagine Lucretia Mott happened to help to form. Only Mabel Vernon and Amelia Walker and Martha Moore ever stood with us. I don't think we had very much support from college women as college women. They might have gone to college or they might not.
Well, this, the reason I brought that up is that I've run into this as a complaint in my own work in the Equal Rights Amendment, that it's an elitist movement. And I wondered if this was true of the women's suffrage movement, and if you had that as an issue.
Well, I think
it probably wasn't an issue then.
No, and I don't think it's an issue now. I never heard anybody raise that idea before that we
really?
Gave preference to college women.
It isn't that you give preference to them. It's that they're the ones that are interested in it, and the implication is that.
Yes, but you know that of all the women's organizations in the United States, when we tried to get the Equal Rights Amendment endorsed at the first hearing in Congress, you know, everybody spoke against it but ourselves, that first hearing.
Yeah.
No one else said a word for the amendment.
Yeah.
And we started out on this campaign to go to all women's conventions, try to change the thought of American women, not to change Congress, because there's no use changing Congress if you couldn't change the thought of American women, because the women would dictate what Congress would do. Now they had the vote. So we stopped much work with Congress and went off to try to change women's attitude on this subject. And of all these women's organizations which have come one by one by one by one by one until now we have practically everyone in America, the last one to come in was the University of Women last summer in Houston.
Yeah.
And next to the last one.
Dallas.
And the last one was the League of Women Voters. And they came in this very year in the autumn.
That's your old National Association grudge, isn't it, that's kept them out for so long?
Well, it might have been the beginning, but I think at present there's very few of them ever heard of it.
Yeah, I should think most of them wouldn't even care.
Didn't know much about it or anything about it. I don't know why. They were just all out for protective labor laws. That was all there was to it. So I think I feel very proud of our organization, I mean of our women and our group, and the type of women, because, you know, women of every experience and every walk of life, you find, have the same feeling for building up respect for their own sex and
mm-hmm.
power for their own sex and lifting it out of a place where there's contempt for women in general.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always felt you, always, I think, when I go into a little group, I don't know whether a single woman will respond, but very often one woman at least responds. And it's you don't know who it's going to be.
There was no prototype that you could always be sure of that
no.
this person would be a pro-suffrage person.
No.
Okay, the other question that I have on administration is sort of on the inner workings. It was prompted by a note that Mary Morris Lockwood had to resign, and this was in June of 1914. So that from May of 1913 to June of 1914, the treasurer's tasks had moved from one desk space to seven large departments, each one equipped with offices and stenographers. And I thought, that was the first time I got a glimpse of how rapid your growth had been and how enormous.
What is that?
The,
I don't understand what you're talking about.
Okay, well, this was, I got this out of a suffragist. When Mary Morris Lockwood resigned, there was a very nice thank you article written for her in the suffragist. And it mentioned that when she first started, there was one space in the office at 1420 F Street that was designated for the treasurer's desk. And it told how she went ahead and worked at her job there, even though all the distractions were
around. That's right, that's all right.
Then in June 1914, there were seven desks or departments. Each one was equipped with offices and stenographers. Now, I think what they mean, each one had their own staff.
Well,
but this was all in the treasury.
That must have been when we moved over. I don't remember when we did move over from our little basement room to the Cameron House, the Dolly Madison House, because then we had a whole building, of course.
Yeah, this was after you moved.
And when we, I don't remember when we moved, but we must have moved before June then of that year. And when we rented this building, known as the Dolly Madison House, out in the back of it, I think this was this building. I don't believe it was, though. Later, it must have been when we was put out of the Dolly Madison House and had to go across into the house that had been William Randolph Hearst. I think that's the one that had this great big building, sort of an annex. And we had the carpenter cut it up into a lot of little offices so that the suffragists could have one office and the treasurer one office and so on, so on, so. But if it was in 1914, we hadn't done that. I suppose that's just taking all the space that we had in the building.
Well, at any rate, it sounded like you had a pretty complicated organization, and that just the just keeping things going from the standpoint of the treasurer and getting the suffragist out and these routine things that had to be done all the time was quite a challenge.
Yeah, well, it certainly was.
And I don't know how you did it. You must not have slept much then either.
Now, my dear, I think you're getting sleepy. Should we go to bed? And I think I'm getting sleepy.
I'm sleepy.
Should we go to bed and get up in the morning?
Yes, that's a good idea. Okay, when
any group...
What about representation on your board?
When any group in our organization didn't seem to have very many members, much representation, then we tried to put that one woman from that group on our board so that everybody would, in the direction of the movement, all people would feel they had a part in it.
This was from any interest group or any social class or economic
class. For instance, we didn't have very many Negroes in our group, although the National Association of Colored Women has always worked very closely with us. So we put one Negro woman, who's one of our ablest and best members, on our national board, and she's there now, you see.
Yeah.
And I remember we had one woman of the former Labor Party out in Minnesota, and she certainly was not a person that had any, she didn't have any college education, didn't have any of these things you're talking about, didn't have any wealth or any social position or anything. But we put her on our national board. That was back in the suffrage days.
Mm-hmm.
And then she finally became our state chairman because she was so extra good.
Oh.
So we've had all types for state chairman in different states.
Well, I think it's very...
We've only had to only judge them by whether they wanted to help and were eager to help and were...
Mm-hmm.
And were really helping.
Mm-hmm. Much. Well, last night we...
And secondly, did you have enough breakfast?
Oh, absolutely.
Was it all right?
It was marvelous.
Well, now what about the milk? Was the milk sour again?
No, no. What happened with the milk was that I took it into the kitchen and then I left it there absent-mindedly And then when my breakfast was served me, I just ate what was on the tray, and I never did go back in the kitchen and pick up my milk again. But I guess she put it in the refrigerator.
She said that she got it this morning. That she got it, bought it from her own house this morning because no place was open when she came.
Oh, bless.
And she said she felt perfectly sure it wasn't so.
No, it's fine. And I thought I would have it. I love it with a banana, and I thought later on
so
I would have it with a banana.
We thought maybe it was sour.
Oh no.
Are you finding much or not finding
much?
Oh,
I found so much in this 1917 volume, Alice, that I hardly know where to start.
Now, this will be very helpful, I think, for Consuelo.
Okay. Now, we ended last night with the memorial service on Inez Mulholland. And then you talked about Jeanette Rankin and her vote against war.
Because it came into our campaign, you know, yeah. So completely. To say we welcomed her, had this welcome meeting, you probably found it in there.
Yes.
And then we had her vote. So she was a big feature, I think, she ought to have a photograph and such in Consuelo's list.
All right.
Don't you think so?
Yes, I do think so. And later on,
the first woman who ever voted, the only woman, she always said, whoever voted never will vote mm-hmm. for the enfranchisement of women in Congress.
Yes, she was one of the sponsors, too, of the bill in that war session of Congress that followed. And of the things I wanted to ask
how
you.
How was it the session that it went through was 1918, wasn't it? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, right now I'm talking about the 1917 session, which it did not go through. But
no, but the 1917 was on war when she cast her vote. And the
yes.
one that she cast her vote on the enfranchisement of women was 1918,
yeah.
I think. Is that right?
That's right. And what I'm talking about is the 1917 war session when she couldn't vote on it because it never got to the floor, but...
I mean, it wasn't there for a vote. It wasn't out.
No, it was not there for a vote. But do you know what she did specifically to try to get it on the floor? Because, you know, it was, as usual, in the House Judiciary Committee.
Are you asking me to answer?
I'm asking you. I just wanted to know because it says that she was a sponsor of it, but I guess it had a lot of sponsors.
Well, she was... Of course, committed to when they say a sponsor, probably. That time we didn't have an official list of sponsors. But she was committed to vote for it and support it, and of course she did. We kept in pretty close contact with her. And whatever she could do, which wasn't much, because everything was turning around the war then. Even all the women's suffrage groups, as I said, were turning into working for the war.
Yeah.
So it wasn't before Congress and wasn't coming before Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I recall, in 1918, they had first one vote, and then they, in the 1919, they had a second vote. Or else they had them both in 1919. There were two votes, I know, in the House.
Yeah, I don't have that chronology right
You
now.
Haven't gotten to it yet, I guess.
Mm-mm.
Well, that's the time that she cast her vote for us, anyway.
Well, in...
That must have been the 19...
Yes.
1919 vote in the House. And it was the previous one, then, when they voted down the 7 years. That's the reason we... paid so much attention to that one because it resulted in our not having to bother with the people working against suffrage. When you I think when you go through all this, it's from Consuelo's point of view, it'll be very helpful because it gives a pretty vivid idea of what drudgery was in it.
Yeah.
Doing it over and over and over again. Just as when you showed me the Russians. I said, well, we had this problem. How can we make it interesting and exciting and dramatic? On and on and on and on. The same plea, the same women, the organization, the same women, or the different women, and the same plan standing at the White House gate. It naturally would get completely dull unless we could think of a new one. So when these Russian people came, I'd forgotten all about it. That was, we immediately seized it as making something different.
I see. And that was when you had...
But not only that, but over and over again, you notice how we changed what we were doing. We would have women from some one state come, or women from someone profession come. It's another thing that this is just a part not to be put in your record at all. When you asked me if we didn't, are you taking this down?
Yes, I am.
Couldn't we stop it right now? I just want to tell you there's something that we brought up last night.
Oh, okay. Well, go ahead, and then we'll just make a note here to the typist to not transcribe it.
All right. I don't object to this being transcribed, but it's not pertinent to what we're talking about now.
Oh.
But last night, you said to me there was a general idea that college women were the women who were conducting this campaign. And I said it was such a new idea to me, and I thought about it after I went to bed. And I was thinking, well, in our present campaign, of course, in our first campaign, not every woman went to college. Now almost every woman's hard to find one of the most obscure and the most impoverished that doesn't go to college. It doesn't mean much. But in our present campaign, where most women have gone to college, as far as I know, Mrs. Chittick, our national chairman, I've never heard of her having gone to college. She never mentioned it. No one's ever heard of it. She may have gone, but she's not revealed it to anyone that I know of. Normally, you talk about when I was at Vassar, when I was in wherever she was. Which was your college? You told me, I've forgotten.
Well, I have three.
Well, all right. Anyway, I don't think if Mrs. Chittick had ever been in college, she would certainly meet somebody who was from a college, and somehow or other we would have heard of a college, but we never have in connection with it. And our first vice chairman, and most one of the most powerful people are now on our board, Mrs. Butler Franklin, is the cousin of Mrs. Belmont. I'm absolutely positive she never been to college. There's our first vice chairman and our national chairman. And I could start and go down the list and think of a lot of people, I'm sure, that even in our today's group have never gone to college. And I think that you, if you're in any kind of a campaign for anything under the sun, whether reform or not, you naturally tend, I guess, to attract to yourself, if you're trying to do something, you want people's help, people who are somewhat akin to you in beliefs and experiences and so on. Well, I don't think I've ever attracted more college women than any other, because I don't have much interest in college, and I know it takes a large slice out of your life that, in my opinion, you could use better if you hadn't gone to college. So I never even inquire whether a person's been to college if they come into our group, and I don't care. I think that they'll probably be better if they haven't been, because they'll have a little more originality, perhaps, and independence. So I thought you might try to somehow or other get that idea across.
Well,
that this was a classless movement. I always felt you go into a crowd and you get up and you make an appeal, and somebody comes to you, like Helen Hunt West came up to me, and that time she never faltered. She just dedicated her life to this campaign. Well, it just struck a kindred note in her. And I found afterwards she had Quaker forebears. Maybe that had something to do with it, but some little time before. But she just was a born feminist. And when somebody presented a way to expedite this, she gave up everything else and threw herself into it. And then you don't ever think, well, have you been to college or not? You just think, well, here is a kindred soul which feels just the same way.
Yeah. Yes, I think it was clear, too, from the examples and things that you had given of getting certain women to come to work, that your feeling, your concern was not whether or not they've been to college, but what particular talents they possessed that the party needed at the time.
Well,
but in most cases,
I never cared much what talents they possessed. We tried to get, and I suppose Mabel Vernon did and all the others who were trying to get people, we tried to get people who were enthusiastic, because there's nothing in the world that's more important than that, enthusiastic and eager and consecrated in their feeling about the movement. That's all we wanted. Then anybody could be of service, you see.
Yeah.
It's always something she could do.
Well, that brings up another characteristic. It seems that this was a young woman's movement, although you had a few old women in it. But
no, I don't think
it was the youth and vitality of it.
I don't think that's true at all.
Oh.
And I very much oppose people saying that, because it was so totally untrue.
Oh.
I think that the people today make a great mistake in saying that, in putting so much emphasis on youth. because we didn't do that at all. And I can remember when we, Lucy Burns and I, went down to Washington, and we were certainly, you would say, young women, and we were always being more or less criticized as pretending to take a position of leadership when we were so young and inexperienced and everything else. With only the fact, I guess, that we had been in prison and had some experience that people overlooked our being so young. But most of the women who came in were not of our age at all. Now, for instance, I told you Mrs. Lawrence Lewis, who was one of the very greatest workers we ever had, and she was a mother and had grown-up sons, two grown-up sons, one grown-up daughter. His son was a physician, and the other son was a lawyer. And the third daughter was living at this lighthouse settlement. I told her where I met Jesse Wilson, President Wilson's daughter. Mm-hmm. And then one of our greatest helpers was Miss Lavinia Dock. Did you ever know who she was?
No. How old was she?
She was an older woman. She was one of the first people who was ever arrested. And I don't know, she might have been 65 or something like that.
Yeah.
But I got to know her in the school of, when I went to the School of Social Work, as they call it now, the School of Philanthropy, we call it. She was one of the distinguished lecturers who came there. She was a world authority, more or less. She was a nurse, and her field was everything to do with these things, what they call venereal and disease and things like that. And then she lived at the Nurses' Settlement in New York, which was just around the corner from us. And so I just got to know her as a humble little pupil of hers in the School of Social Work. So when we began to try to gather a group together in Washington, all these people I'd ever met or knew, I would telephone to her, go to see, and ask if they would help us. So she came right down, and she was the founder of the International Nurses Association. And when this busy nurse of mine came here, I said, "Did you ever know Lavinia Dock?" She said, "Of course, we all study her textbooks. She's one of the greatest, greatest women ever in the field of nursing." And when we started to have the picketing and being arrested, she was the first one of the first group, I'm almost certain. If she wasn't the first, almost the first. And no one could possibly say she was young. And here she was, a professor. All these younger people were still going to school, to the people of the age of Miss Lavinia Dock. And then there was another one who founded the nursing school at Yale. And I'll look up her name. She was, of course, the same age about as Miss Dock. And she was a very cultured and what one would call upper-class person. And she went into nursing, and she was very shocked to find that and I won't say shocked, but she was distressed to find that the women in the nursing field were, she thought, not very suitable to be nurses. They were, they hadn't had any, she thought, maybe they'd had nursing training, but they hadn't had anything else. So she went to Yale and persuaded them to open a school of nursing and make it a regular school like medicine or law or anything else of the university on the same scale, the same standing, and it was set up. And women's then did start to go in and become nurses who never would have had a chance to have that training before. Do you want me to go on?
Yes, go ahead.
I
was watching your tenant is leaving. And I thought you might want to know.
Yes, because now you put that down.
Put the heat down.
As soon as she gets out of the way safely. Well, then she was one of our pillars. And she got this great nursing, National Association of Nurses to endorse and support us and work with us. She was certainly not a young woman at all. And then, of course, Mrs. Belmont was not a young woman.
Yeah.
And then when we, one time in Washington, Mrs. Belmont conceived the idea that she might give a dinner. at the Willard Hotel, where she always went, where she'd been a patron for years, and sort of try to get moving into the social world to attract some people that might not come otherwise. So she gave this dinner, and she invited, she told us to invite whom we wanted, all our national board, all our state chairman, everybody that had been important in our movement, to have maybe, I think, about 600 or something like that, maybe 1,000. This enormous dinner. And I remember this person from Yale, whose name I can easily find, I'm sure, in the suffragist. Well, she was one of the, one of the leaders that we naturally invited. And then there was Isetta Jewell Miller. You know anything about her? From
yes.
California?
Yes, I know that she is a Californian and that she...
She's a Californian now. She never
now,
was.
And she was from Virginia?
West Virginia.
West Virginia.
Well, when I went to Washington, she was in what they call the stock company of Washington. And she was the most admired and beloved and most beautiful and most successful young woman actress that there was. And she then married Congressman Brown. And she was the first woman in the country that ever presided at the National Democratic Convention after we got the vote.
Oh, yes.
And it never had happened before. And she brought her little daughter June up. Well, I would say June would have been a young one, but the one who really was the person who was always working and doing everything was the mother. We have paintings of both of them in the headquarters down in the living room, you may remember.
I do.
Well, now, this Isetta Jewell, she was... You couldn't think of the Woman's Party without thinking of Isetta Jewell. So you see, none of these women were young. But at this time, after she married Congressman Brown, she took over the state chairmanship of West Virginia, which her mother had had. And was all through this period, coming up to our meetings and so on in Washington, as the state chairman of West Virginia.
Oh, was that through the suffrage period?
Yes, through the suffrage period. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to me one time, when I was perhaps impatient, I guess, or something or other, about people asking so many questions, he said, "But you know, I've taken this long trip up from West Virginia just to ask you these questions, so we'll know what to do." I remember so vividly. Mm-hmm. So, when you think of the people who put through that campaign, and Mrs. Florence Byard Hillis, you can never call a young woman, you know, she was one of our most active people. But of course she was grown up with a grown-up daughter at the time we first met her. And the sister of the United States Senator, she was about the age of the senators and so on. Well, I just go on and on and on. Mary Beard, who became the chairman of our committee to decide on what amendment we should work for.
Yeah.
Well, she was certainly not a young woman.
Oh.
Her husband was already, and she already established as... I knew all about them when she told me her name was Mary Beard, and I said, "Well, are you related to Charles Beard?" And she said, "Yes, I'm his wife." Well, everybody knew about them. Mm-hmm. I mean, she'd had time to make fame for herself and her husband in these books she was writing. So you did not have much feeling that we tried to get young women and old women, any women we could get, yeah. Of course. But I would not say that our movement was a young woman's movement at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think I've read this statement in made by people who were contrasting the advent of the Congressional Union with the leadership in the National American Women's Suffrage Association, that here was Alice Paul, who was under 30, I guess, weren't you, in 1914, just barely?
I'm almost sure that the year I went down, I was 27.
Yeah.
Because I'd just taken my doctor's degree, and I think I was 27.
And Lucy Burns.
Was about 2 years older, I guess.
Who were the young and vital leaders, and that gave the campaign its character. Now, I know you didn't...
But that wasn't true, you see. Now, yeah. Mrs. Richard Wainwright,
mm-hmm.
Here was her husband, who was the...
Admiral,
you know. And she was she was our house chairman, and she got us this new headquarters, yeah. When we moved from our little basement place. And all these Mrs. William Kent.
Yeah.
There was never anybody who was more active every single day than Mrs. William Kent. So we didn't really have any such feeling at all. We were immature and all the things that they were trying to say we were. They were really trying to say I was, you see.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
And that Lucy Burns was, perhaps. Yeah. But anyway, they certainly had it out for me. They thought I was immature and I didn't know what I was doing.
And that was something
I was unreliable and I wasn't. I didn't know what were good things to do and what were bad things to do for the campaign and all.
Yeah. Well, now when people look back on this, I think they tend to see your youth as an advantage instead of a disadvantage to the movement.
Well, but then that's what I want to avoid. They're thinking so because it wasn't true.
That's
it
not
was
true.
It was a very stable group of women from the very beginning. Oh. You can tell from all these people I'm telling you about. These are a few just crossed my mind. Now, Mrs. Robert Baker, if you looked in this magazine, and more younger, they were not young. Mrs. Baker she was our political chairman all through the suffrage campaign. She had one desk and one room all to herself. She was the one who went to see all these senators and governors and everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she was the wife of a physician, and she had three sons, and I think one son was still in Harvard, and the other two sons were out in the world. I think one of them went into the army. I've forgotten, but anyway, she couldn't possibly say she was a very young person. And then this Mrs. Forrest, who got up most of our pageants and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
She was not young at all. So the people that we got in who were young were when we started to do it, and I think, for instance, I remember that Ann Martin, you know, couldn't possibly call her young. She wasn't old or either. She was. You wouldn't have thought of a particularly young woman. She was the one who ran, you know, for Senate.
Yes.
Again.
Yes, I do. And is this the same Graham that right now puts out the Congressional Digest?
Yes, but now, of course, she's retired more. That's her son, doesn't it? But
it is the same woman.
It's the same woman. Well,
Anne
Martin went with, among many other people over the country to try to explain the picketing and make people sympathetic to it and so on. And she stopped in the University of Oregon. And there, two young girls were thrilled at the idea to be invited down to Washington to participate, and they came. I remember so vividly when they came, people went to me and said, "You must quickly see these two girls and see they don't go back to Oregon, because they would be such tremendous help to us." One was Betty, who became Betty Graham Swing, you know. She married Raymond Swing, remember? And she was young, and she was still in college. And then the sister Alice was in college with her. And so we enlisted them right away, and they turned in, and we gave them small little salaries to pay their expenses so they could stay on. And they did stay on, and they stayed till the very end.
But that was the exception rather than the rule in age.
No, I wouldn't say it was an exception. I just, until you told me about it, I never heard, given much thought to this being. I know that you go out now to the Democratic Convention, and we're told all this is all youth, wanting what they want. You know, they even call, they say we're standing for this minority and that minority, women and youth, you know. And you can't fail to realize it over the television. That's what they're emphasizing, the great beauty of the youth. You must know that.
Yes, but that's even younger than, and that's in a different context from what I'm talking about in 1914 and 15.
No, it's
when
the
your
same thing
started,
exactly.
Because these people are even younger than the ones that, I think, than the young ones in your movement.
Well, those I met haven't been any younger than I've met in
the
liberation movement.
18 to 22-year-olds. Right. And I'm talking about those that were in their late 20s for the most part, I think, who came to your movement. But at any rate, you've convinced me that this is a multi-age movement, that it was a multi-age movement.
When you say about this women's liberation, I haven't met very many. But those I've met, well, for instance, when I was in this hospital, somebody came in to see me, and she said she was a nurse down the hall for some man and who was very, very ill and had a terminal disease and so on. I think she came from Austria. I've forgotten where she came from some foreign country. And then she was all ablaze with this woman liberation, and she brought me in a paper to read all about homosexuality and so on. I didn't think very much of this person, but I certainly didn't. But she, you wouldn't have said she was so young. She was old enough to come to and from another country, gotten an education and spoke English and everything in this country, and was now a professional nurse, only earning an enormous sum by going and being a special nurse for these people with great wealth in the hospital, in addition to their hospital nurse. Mm-hmm. So I met just a few of them, and now there's one of them called Gloria Steinem. Mm-hmm. I've never met her, but this magazine that the girl brought in was this Gloria Steinem magazine.
And is that the one called MS?
I don't know what it's called, I don't remember. I gave it back to the girl, she wanted it back. And I just glanced at it, and I didn't read it. So, but this Gloria Steinem, I saw over the television at the Democratic National Convention. And we had been trying, as you know, to get our equal rights plank in. Mm-hmm. And we had an extremely difficult time, extremely difficult, because all the women's liberation were wanting to put in all these other things. And so here I saw this Gloria Steinem get up and make a speech for all the things that they wanted. And other girls, other women, I'd say women, they didn't give the appearance of being teenagers at all.
No, they're not.
I think that these teenagers you talk about are people who sort of, they're not, I don't think, the leaders who are guiding this movement.
Oh, no. No, they're the new voters who are just franchised.
Yes, I think that's what they're
talking about. Yeah. Well,
anyway, I wanted to say this.
Is there any way, Alice, that you could characterize the women in this movement? Is there any trait or characteristic that any of them had in common?
I always thought there was one thing that they all had in common, which I presume you have. I don't know, but I think you have. Which was a feeling of loyalty to her own sex and an enthusiasm to have every degradation that was put upon her sex removed. That's what I had anyway. It was just a principle that if I belonged to any group, and that group was regarded with contempt and given no power and handicapped in every possible way, it seemed to me, I'd have an impulse. If, for instance, if I had been in India when they were fighting for the freedom of India, if I'd been in Ireland when they were fighting for the freedom of Ireland, I can't imagine not, just when I went as a student to England, I just couldn't dream of sitting down and seeing these women have such a hard fight, which was also, I thought, the universal fight of women, and not wanting to share in it. Mm-hmm. And as I say, when Alice Morgan Wright got up and left her sculptor work in Paris, where she was very successful, and came over, she just always, we just became sisters right away. We just felt the same way.
Yeah.
Although I didn't meet her over there until she came back to this country.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems to me that's been the only thing that's united us.
Yeah.
And while so many women think, what's the difference? And as you know, through the suffrage campaign, we didn't have very much support from the women of the country. We had this big and powerful organization against suffrage for women, and almost no group that, as a group, that came in to help us.
Yeah.
You just had to go forth and get individual women to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's the same feeling that Margaret Brent must have had, I've always felt, and Abigail Adams, and so on down, and Lucretia Mott, and I just feel I know that they had that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because they never talked about advantages. These people talk now about equality for women, liberation women. They're always talking about advantages to women, how you'll get promoted and how you'll get more pay and so on, so on, so, which is such a different feeling from the dignity of your sex that you're trying to get, and the freedom. So I think if we get freedom for women, then they're probably going to do a lot of things that I would wish they wouldn't do. But it seems to me that isn't our business to say what they shall do with their freedom. It's our business to see that they're free. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just in each country, when it gets freedom, then you don't... George Washington, after he got it, didn't start in and try to tell the Americans how they must live and what they must do and so on. Mm-hmm. He just... And I thought that's our duty, same way. Mm-hmm. Now...
Well,
do you agree with that or not?
I do agree with it. Sure I do.
Because I thought, I just felt you, I haven't asked you anything, but I took for granted that you were of this point of view.
Yes, well, I am. And when we have lunch or dinner, why, I can tell you more about it. I just don't want to take up our time right now to fill it with my experiences. But
if you tell me you agree with it, well, that's all. I would be sorry if you didn't. But I meet so many people, it's rather rare we meet anybody who does feel this way.
Oh, it is rare?
Yes, very rare. Most, you can see from what people do with their lives, almost, here was a great national campaign where this measure was one of the measures in their platform. Well, even McGovern's own staff, as I said, the women in his own staff, even the women in our group, like Mrs. Colby, could say, oh, well, we telephoned down to Mr. Mankiewicz. It's not anything that they think is a burning need for the country.
Yeah. I wonder if...
Our fight is that almost everybody there are just a few people over the country, and now I try to keep in touch with them by telephone, like this Mary Kennedy. Well, they were born feminists, and they cannot help themselves. That's the way they were born. That's all there is to say about it. And this Georgia Lloyd, I just called me up from Illinois. One here and one there in a different state saying, this campaign now, this ratification campaign is on, what should we do? What about one, you think, out of the million of women there must be in Illinois?
Yeah.
Who's all on fire over this.
Yeah.
And usually there's so much on fire that they transform their states.
And you work through these that are really on fire then in the various states from your telephone here.
But that's the only way. And I remember once asking Helen Hunt West on the floor to do something, and she said, you know, from till the end of my life, you may know that this is the only thing I'm going to do, and so don't worry about me. I'm always going to be here to do the next thing that has to be done.
It's a real commitment. Let me test this and see if it's going to come across with the vacuum cleaner on.
Doing with my voice, am I speaking too loud or too low? Or
it sounds perfect to me. Just fine.
Because it's only for you to get the notes from.
It comes across loud and clear, fortunately.
And now let's go back to Europe.